Welcome back, everyone, to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. Why? Because that's all I do, amicable divorces. Gabrielle Hartley, attorney licensed in Massachusetts and New York, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here with you today.
So let's let the audience know everything you do. So I am so happy that we're doing this interview because we have tried to do this for over a year. COVID, I had to learn Zoom, everything. But, you know, things work out as they should. And I'm just thrilled to have you available. You are a child of divorce. This whet your appetite for going into the line of work that you did. And please spend a moment on that in a second. But Gabrielle started out as a family law attorney. And as I mentioned a minute ago, she's licensed in two states, New York and Massachusetts. After a career in litigation, she moved on to mediation, which is where she loves to sit. Right, Gabrielle?
That's correct.
The most. And then she wrote a phenomenal book called, and I love this title more than you know, Better Apart. I enjoyed reading it, and we're going to also talk about that because I think just what you put in that book is so positive, so helpful. Thank you for writing the book, too. So let's start with you as a child. What was your experience as a child of divorce?
So, I grew up in New York City in the later 70s and 80s, and at the time where I was a kid, I went to public school in Brooklyn, and practically my whole class had divorced parents, except for two other kids and me. And then in third grade, my parents split up, and unlike all the other divorced kids, I had a dad who stuck around and had shared parenting with my mom long before that was a thing. We were like the weird divorced family who got along. And I said we, like, because I'm part of the divorce. People sometimes say to me, you know, you haven't been divorced. How can you write about being divorced? And I say, well, I changed houses every day. I slept in four bedrooms every week for 10 years of my life, every 10 days. And, you know, it was my childhood. All of our childhoods are just what we know. We don't know what it's like to be anybody else. But it wasn't bad. It was kind of fun. It was interesting. It was colorful. But I was very aware of the fact that my parents were different. And different is never good, right? Different is weird, even though I actually think it is good, you know, but we were sort of weird. And then when I went to law school, I didn't want to take family law. You know, mic drop. I was done with divorce. I was like, this has been a theme of my life and I'm not interested. So I took family law, pass fail. But of course, I was very interested in it. I knew a lot. I had a lot of thoughts and opinions. But I was in my 20s, and I just wasn't ready really to dig in. And then I found myself clerking for a judge in New York.
Well, wait a minute. Before we get to New York and the judge, a couple of things I want to ask about your experience as a child of divorce. You said you slept in four bedrooms. In a week, yeah, so, 2 weeks, how is it four bedrooms? You only have two parents.
So, you know, this might say, if you're not from New York City, this might sound like, you know, super duper privileged. It really was more commonplace than you might imagine at that. You have to remember at that time, each property wasn't $2 million or more. So each of my parents had one place in the city and they each had a country house.
Oh, okay.
So, every weekend that I was with either parent, I either went to the Berkshires or the Poconos.
Got it.
And so I had, I had a lot of siblings. I mean, I have one brother, but yeah. Ask me whatever you like. I'll tell you whatever you want.
So that really clarifies that. You're kind of like the New York City housewives. They have their places in Manhattan, and then they have, you know.
We were like Brooklyn and the New York side of the Berkshires, which is right. My parents were like teachers. It wasn't fancy, but whatever. It was a nice lifestyle. According to them, they were always saying like, do you know how many kids would kill to have these houses? And I was thinking like, not really, because I had to miss a lot of socializing, but I read a lot.
All right. Now listen, you brought up some really good points in quick succession that all kids deal with. So first of all, One of the things children say when they're asked about their concerns after being told that their parents are going to divorce, their concerns are, do we still get to keep our friends? Am I going to move out of the neighborhood? Will I have to move schools? And it really seems at the end of the day, Gabrielle, and this is perfect for you to answer, all the kids want is for their parents to get along and all this other stuff can be ironed out. True, not true.
100% true.
And you were the lucky one that your parents got along.
And let's be real here. It's not like they got along. Like, I remember the crying, the screaming, the yelling, the hanging up the phones. I mean, I remember it. I remember it well. And that's one of the reasons when people come to me as, you know, to be their lawyer or to be their mediator, I'm not really hung up on not having too many transitions for the kids throughout the week. What I'm really very focused on is how can we mitigate conflict as much as possible? Because kids will thrive in myriad situations, but where we see suffering is where they're in the middle of the fight. And that can be really hard to avoid for some people if they're constantly having to see one another, which is a reason that often we have drop-off and pickups happen at school, so there's less face-to-face combat.
And a lot of people around, so you're on your best behavior rather than at your own homes. But I read in your book, which we will talk about a little bit later, I read in your book, I think your parents lived within the same block or a couple blocks away in Brooklyn, right?
They did until I was 12. And then my mom moved to be closer to her now husband of 40 years to Staten Island. And then my dad bought a little house right by where she moved so that we could all be close together. So, you know, it was really important to my dad to be very, very involved. I can remember he wanted to move right to the same street where my mother lived, and my mother was not having that. So, but he did move while my brother and I were in school on Staten Island. And then, then he moved back to Brooklyn.
And I love hearing this only because I think men get a bad rap. They're not nurturing. And you only hear about the dads that don't want to be involved. I love hearing about the dads.
I work with a lot of dads. I do a lot of divorce strategy coaching for dads just to keep them in the game. I don't know how they find me, but they do. I think men get a really bad rap. And like, my dad was amazing. And there's a lot of men who are not the best husbands who can be fantastic fathers. And, you know, you shouldn't let your ex talk you out of that because your kids need you.
Yes, they do. And the kids aren't part of the reason for the divorce, ergo why kids cannot choose sides, should not choose sides. Parental alienation should never be part of the equation. It's just so hurtful. And hoping that you weren't part of that equation.
Exactly. No, I mean, I feel very lucky. And that's what I was segueing into when I was talking about the judge, is I realized, it wasn't until I worked for the judge that I realized how lucky I was. Like, I always thought like, oh my God, my parents are so crazy. Why do they keep saying how great their divorce is? It's not that great. You know, like, and it wasn't until I was really in the trenches and I was like, oh, I see how really horrible things are.
It can be. I know. It's so subjective what good and bad is. But before we leave you as a child of divorce, one last thing that you experienced, I believe, was blended family.
Oh my gosh. Yes, absolutely.
Can you speak to that a little bit? What are the challenges and the rewards?
I mean, are we saying, we're limiting this to a few minutes because we could have a whole podcast on this. You know, blending family, like from my perspective now as an adult, I'm really grateful that I have my stepsister who's as close to me as my closest first cousin. You know, like we're really, really good friends. And people often thought we looked like twins. I met her when I was 10 and she was 11. And when she got divorced, she actually came and lived with me for a while before she got resituated and now married. But, you know, it's really hard. I was just thinking about how my dad had a girlfriend who lived with us whose ex wasn't really in the picture. And then when my stepsister person, the daughter who lived with us, she turned 16, and my dad threw her a sweet 16 party as though he were the dad. And I remember being a little bit like, you know, it just felt weird. And I remember my father taking me aside and giving me a little talk. And I remember saying, oh, I don't care, it's fine. And it was fine. But I did feel a little bit like it was strange. And then, you know, there's a lot of dynamics, like different, my stepsister lived mostly with her mother, and her mother had very different rules than my mother had, and very different spending. And like, so we were like the same age, and she had all these like clothes that my mom wouldn't let me get or buy for me. And she had a lot higher allowance than I had, and that irritated me. And my dad had a different girlfriend every 3 years, more or less. And I'd have these like Insta families, and they were all different like races, religions, like a real array, and everyone had different rules and different expectations. So I was really involved with my friends and my schoolwork. Sort of like my escape was, I was like highly, highly functional. I was like, you know, my friends used to kid with me that I was like a Reese Witherspoon in Election, like, you know, like president of the class, you know, lead of the play. You know, I just really was a high achieving, high performer. And I avoided a lot of it. I can remember my dad coming to my bedroom while everyone was outside doing whatever they were doing, and I was doing homework, and he would come in and say, all work and no play makes Gabrielle a dull girl. And I was like, get out.
No, you were right. All work and maybe a little bit of play got you to be the enormously positive, high energy, hugely successful person who you are. And I am very lucky to meet you. I mean that. So you turned everything around. You used it for your own good. And I marvel at you, Gabrielle. I marvel at you. All right, now let's marvel at you in the courthouse. So fast forward to, you're done with law school, and now you're in the family law world. Tell us what you did.
So I was lucky enough to clerk for Judge Jeffrey Sunshine, who is presently the chief administrative judge for the New York State Divorce Court. So he's sort of like in charge of matrimonial court, as it's called in New York, in the Supreme Court. And what I did with him, in addition to drafting preliminary drafts of his legal decisions, is I spent an enormous amount of time each and every day helping resolve trial-ready cases, meaning that they're literally about to have a full-blown trial, and cases that were just high conflict and they're in court with motions, meaning they go to court because they want some specific remedy by the judge. And so what my job was at that time was to sit with the two lawyers and the two parties and help them to come up with some kind of settlement, reasonable resolution that would help them to totally avoid all the aggravation, finances, making bad memories, blah, 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 of trial. And so I did that for several years, day in and day out. And I loved it. I mean, it was really high pressure. It was really intense. At the time, I wouldn't say I loved it. I mean, I was good at it, but I wouldn't have said I loved it because it was a lot of stress.
Because when you're at the courthouse, and so you can shine an amazing window on what it's like in court for all of our listeners, because I don't think people understand the legal lane, so to speak, that judges have to work in to provide orders. They don't go emotional, that they don't have a soft heart. They have requirements, correct?
Yeah. And so, I mean, I always say, beware the stranger in black robes, right? Because they can only hear a really narrow set of facts. What you may think matters may not be legally relevant. I mean, if you can resolve things without going to court, you should. And the only piece of advice I would give you if you're listening is before you meet with a mediator, especially if your mediator is not a lawyer where you are mediating, like if people from California hire me, I'm not a California lawyer, I don't know the law. I want you to come to me knowing what your rights are. I want you to know what's your best alternative if you go to court and what's your worst alternative when you go to court. Because from there, we have space. That's the container where you should be making your decisions.
Completely
agree. What I learned was that the courthouse literally stirs up like a vat all of the animosity, right? Like, and there are so many rabbit holes for the lawyers to go down. And it's not even like they're thinking, oh, I'm going to have this fight because I'm going to make more money. They're just having the fight because that's how a lot of them define their job. Personally, being someone who grew up with divorced parents who stayed out of court, I'm so grateful that my parents didn't go to court. And I was never that kind of lawyer. I never enjoyed litigating other than academically. I mean, it was like fun, but the idea of like, you know, crushing someone on the stand never really worked for me because that person may be highly imperfect, but at the end of the day, I don't want to destroy somebody else's parent. I don't think it serves anyone. I just don't think court serves anyone in most instances.
And, you know, also, Gabrielle, no, I don't go to court, obviously. I'm a mediator in California and a paralegal on steroids. So I have this extra license to be a document preparation company. I file for what we call amicable divorces. I don't do the motions, you know, I don't write litigation briefs, nothing like that. Simple, simple, simple. Most of the people who come to me never go to court. But in your role in the courthouse, and you were called the closer, which I absolutely love that. Okay, so we're in the courthouse. Just being in the courthouse, it's a very sterile environment, but it's a very fearful environment. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think people feel very uncomfortable in court. I worked there, so it's a little bit of a different feeling. Right. But it stirs up fear. It stirs up intimidation. I think that's the word. It's very intimidating. I hesitate to say that it's always worse, because if you are trying to divorce someone who will not come to the table, or you're trying to divorce someone who's coming to the table with lies or, you know, all kinds of reasons, sometimes court is necessary, even to just bring someone to the table. And that's okay. I mean, there's a reason I'm of counsel to a premier law firm in Manhattan, because often I get calls from somebody who says, oh, I really want to litigate. And then I start talking to them and I think, and then I say, you know, I don't want to waste your money or my time. You do not have a case that you can litigate. And I do my best to try to hook them up, depending on where they live, with a lawyer who can really go to town, which is unfortunately necessary sometimes. I know we were talking about mediation and not why litigation is necessary, but if any of your listeners find themselves feeling bad that they have to go to court, like I just want to give you permission not to feel bad. It is a necessary evil sometimes.
Exactly. And what I say to my mediation couples and my filing couples is, look, if you can make your agreements outside of court and we just file them in court, of course that's the best way. You know each other better than any judge will ever get to know you inside of a courtroom. And we're all imperfect beings. So, you know, nobody has time in a courtroom situation to peel the onion back to look at what your motivations were, which may have been pure and just executed improperly. You never know. But I do say to people, especially if there are mental health challenges, if there are substance abuse challenges, if there are personality disorders, like maybe a little sociopathology, extreme narcissism, something that you, the average spouse, simply don't have control over. That's what court's for. It's there to make decisions. But in so doing, I pray to God they get the right attorneys who want to minimize the exposure in court and really just help the people come to a decision.
And if I can say, sometimes you, if you find yourself up against someone who's incredibly aggressive, if you hire someone like me, you're going to do yourself a disservice. Because while I'm aggressive, like I wouldn't be fighting really what you'd call dirty, right? Like when I'm doing a family law case, a lawyer who is more resolution oriented tends to try, like you just said, Judy, to be working toward the goal of resolving, right? But if you're with like a terrorist on the other side, then your best defense may be a strong offense.
You know, that's so important to know because there just are those cases. There just are those cases where there are people who won't even follow a court order. What do you do? I mean, literally, what does a person do, Gabrielle, where they have a ton of orders? I guess you go to the police. If the police, what do you do?
You file a contempt. So in order to get a court order enforced, you need to show at least the standard where I practice is a clear and unequivocal court order that's been violated. So failure to adhere to the terms of a clear and unequivocal court order. So this is why whenever I do a mediation, I do my very best to help the parties to arrive at an agreement that's quite specific. I do not include agreements to agree. The parties believe that they can work out an amicable parenting plan. That is a recipe for disaster because then the person who doesn't have the kids most of the time could take 6 or 8 or 9 months to get into court to even see their kids. You need to establish a basic plan. Make it hard now and you'll have an easier time later. Don't worry about spending an extra $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 on your mediator. Do not worry about that. Go in and have the hard conversations and work out those details. I realize we didn't even explain what a mediator does.
No, I was going to move into that in a second.
Sorry.
I finish up what the experience in court was like. And I just wanted to ask you one final question before we go into the value of mediation, what it is, how you handle it, etc. And that is, what did you find were the most difficult aspects of dealing with the two attorneys in court ready to go into trial?
Oh my God, I loved it so much. I can't just say, that is the kind of pressure that I really thrive under, like getting disparate people to come to agreement is sort of like my superpower. So I wouldn't say that was... Yeah, that's something like I always say I'm really bad at so many things, but unless you have a lawyer who's like a terrorist lawyer who just wants to try the case, in those cases, there's nothing to do. But, you know, let's say out of every 100 lawyers, you only get a couple, less than a handful of lawyers who are like that. I loved it. I didn't find anything about that hard. I just loved it.
Okay, and I totally understand that from your point of view that you loved it. I guess I was just looking for, and you really did touch upon it, there will be situations when you have, quote unquote, a terrorist lawyer, and there's nothing you can do, and you just have to send them into the courtroom, right?
Exactly. Yeah. The other thing that can be hard is a relocation case.
Say what that is.
So, like, if someone, say, like, you live in California and your spouse wants to be a theater actress in Manhattan and they want to go to Manhattan and they want to take the kid, well, that's complicated. What are their, you know, there's so many complicating factors around that, right? Like, what are their hours going to be? How are they going to take care of the kid? And you're moving across the country. I mean, there are issues that are really hard to resolve. And most of the relocation cases that I've been involved in have been East to West Coast relocations. And oftentimes it's because people are in theater. I mean, in movies, or they're writers for movies. Because I'm located on the East Coast, I don't really experience people moving to the East Coast. More likely that they move to the West Coast, or they move to work for a big corporation and, you know, in Texas or something. And more often than not, the kids in those cases often wind up staying primarily most of the time with mom, but we usually, when we're able to resolve them, we get dad a crap ton of time with the kids throughout the year. And we try to build in certain things so that the kids still want to go to dad's even in the summer when their kids are more important. I mean, their friends are important. So, it can be complicated. Those cases are hard. You cannot negotiate. If you're a newly trained mediator, don't take that as your first case because it's not easy.
So now let's go into mediation. So you spent X number of years in the courtroom. How and when did you transition into mediation and why?
So I have always been doing mediation from the beginning because the issue is more that why did I stay with litigation for so long, right? So I was also doing the litigation, but I never loved it. My heart was never in it, but I felt like I wasn't going to be seen as like a real lawyer if I just mediated. I felt like there is a lack of respect of mediators by many lawyers. And I really struggled with it a lot. You know, I wanted, like I said in the beginning, I was sort of like, always very high achieving, very achievement oriented, respect oriented. And I really couldn't stand the idea that my peers might sort of look askance at me, like, oh, she's not really a lawyer, she's just a mediator, right? And so the question is, why did it take me so long and how did I shift, right? And so what really catapulted it was when Gwyneth Paltrow said that she consciously uncoupled in 2014, I said to my husband, I'm going to write the book that's going to be the conversation-changing divorce book. And I'm going to get a big publisher to publish it. And I'm going to get Gwyneth Paltrow's endorsement on the front cover. And I know you guys can't see me because we're not on video, but here's my book, Better Apart, The Radically Positive Way to Separate, which Harper Wave, which is a subsidiary of HarperCollins, put out. And Gwyneth says, potent, accessible tools for you and your family's future. So once my book came out, I felt like I could no longer even pretend to play dirty. Like, that wasn't my game anyway. And I just decided to really lean in 100% into the positive divorce practice.
So you were transitioning into mediation a little before writing the book, or as you were writing the book?
So my practice has always been called Hartley Law and Mediation. I've always been doing mediation. Historically, so I worked for Judge Sunshine.
Well, I was going to say, it actually sounds like you used the tools of mediation when you were in the courtroom for the judge.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So that's almost more conciliation because it was guided with the law, right? So mediation is more client guided. Although, as a lawyer mediator, I'm always thinking about the law. Even if I'm mediating for people who are not in my state, I'm always very aware of what the issues are. I just don't know what the laws are, but I know what to ask the parties to talk to their lawyers about, much as I'm sure you do in California.
Absolutely. And I always say, please have your lawyers take a look at this settlement agreement before we file it. It becomes your contract moving forward. Let's leave nothing unaddressed. Okay, so as a mediator, what are your challenges? I think I want people to know more and more that mediation is a phenomenal option and one that you should try if at all possible. But it's not easy, is it?
So mediation is where you hire a third-party, neutral, impartial person to help you and your spouse or ex-spouse to navigate either issues or your total case. And the thing you have to bear in mind is all of us, as we're all flooded hearing right now all about, like, you know, justice and access to justice and bias and implicit bias, your mediator, like your judge, they're just a person. They are going to have certain biases, right? And these days, most mediators are aware of that. We're constantly getting educated in that. You know, I'm very involved in the American Bar Association mediation section. And in fact, this week I co-chaired the mediation week, and it was all about access to justice, where we were talking a lot about diversity. And it's not just diversity, you know, black, white, Asian, whatever. It's not just ethnic or gender, but it's also, you know, socioeconomic. It is also physical impairments. There's so many different things. And this person who you're hiring is charged with being impartial and with helping you to get to the finish line of reaching a reasonable resolution that you and your spouse and your family can live with as you go forward. So what is so difficult about mediation is that you have to stay at the table. And sometimes sitting at the table is hard. Sometimes you're going to want to take a glass of water and toss it at your ex because they're saying things that aren't true. Sometimes your mediator is going to feel like they heard what the other side had to say and not what you had to say. But if you stay at the table, which might mean asking, you might have to take a break in order to stay, right?
Right.
Maybe you have to walk away. Maybe you have to take some deep breaths. If you stay at the table, most of the time you're going to wind up with an outcome that is much more favorable than what you're going to get in court, because in court, the judge does not hear you for very long. It is much less likely to be really ugly at the table, as in court it can get incredibly ugly.
How does it get uglier in court than people fighting in a mediation room?
So, first of all, I don't have that much, you know, the mediator really sets the tone. So the mediation room should really be an environment where the talking is a bit controlled. People are instructed in the beginning to take turns speaking. I will pause the mediation when if people are talking over each other. It is true that sometimes people will try in the mediation to start rehashing things that happened in the marriage, you know, if someone had an affair or something like that. But I usually start the mediation by goal setting. That way, when we start to get off track, we can come back to the goal and get people back on the path for why they hired me to start with. In court, it's just mudslinging, like a ugly political, you know, like a campaign, really. That's what it's like. It's like a campaign for custody, a campaign for alimony. It's a whole other level. You cannot imagine how ugly things get. Lawyers are like playing a game of basketball. They're just trying to win. They're most 9 out of 10 lawyers are literally going into court to get you the kids, get you the money, save you the money. You know, they're not there to create a healthy path forward. So, I mean, I personally think
well said. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Well said. Well said. They are not there to create a healthy path forward.
That's just not what their charge is. See, I would say, you know, when you're in law school, you are taught that you have to be a zealous advocate. Okay. What I would say is that in family law, zealous advocacy takes on a different meaning, because I think that if you are not zealously advocating for the family, whatever that reconfigured family is, I would say that you are causing maybe unintended collateral damage, but collateral damage nonetheless. And that, again, that's why I wrote Better Apart, because I really wanted to empower people to keep being positive, to engage their inner agency, to become stronger, to become more mindful of their decisions, to step away from the blame game and enter into a space where there's clarity so that they can make better decisions, whether it be in court, in mediation, or well after the ink is dry on their divorce. You know, when is it worth fighting and when is it worth to just walk away?
Divorce is an issue of compromise. I say this every single day to people. Life is an issue of compromise. And I don't know that compromise can be left out of the mediation process. So that leads me to another question for you, and that is, do you insist that people get legal advice before they come in to your mediations?
I strongly advise. I do not insist.
I know, because you can't really force them, can you? You don't know.
Oh, you can.
Can you?
You can have in your agreement. You can only meet with people who've met with lawyers. But
okay.
You can do whatever you want. I mean, it's your business. You can also, you know, in the middle of the mediation, if you find that you're biased, you can withdraw from the mediation. You know, you might want to return the people money if you withdraw after you've had a bunch of meetings. But I mean,
I do believe that is a good business practice, by the way. That if the professional is going to withdraw, you should refund something to these people.
It depends.
Well, okay, you're right, it depends. But let's go back to, A, how important is it to get legal advice, Gabrielle?
I think that you should unequivocally find out what your rights are before you make any agreements. And the reason for that is once you suggest, I might be open to this, that, or the other thing, something happens at the mediation session known as anchoring. People will start to think that that is on the table. If you offer something that is outside the realm of what you're really going to be willing to give, good luck pulling it back. You're going to find yourself thrown into court when you could have just avoided that by holding your tongue a little bit longer until you really figured out what you wanted, knowing all the facts and circumstances. Now, some people do not care about the law. They do not care what their rights are. They just want to be guided by themselves. And that's fine. I mean, the way I view it is like, my clients are adults and they're free to make whatever bad agreements they want to make. But as an officer of the court, I'm going to do my darndest to try to make sure that the playing field is evened out and that everybody's thinking things through.
Well, you have this uneven dynamic, though. If one person has gotten legal advice and additionally been provided a little bit of a reality check, if you went to court, this is the range of the range of options a judge would have in these aspects of your case. And the other person has said, no, thank you. I just want to go in. And the person who hasn't gotten legal advice starts asking for things that are so outside of legal reality that you leave the person with legal advice kind of stuck, maybe, then they have to be, how do you untangle that? One person knows what the law is pretty much, the other person doesn't, you're the mediator, and the ask is pretty big and wide.
I just tell them you need to go seek counsel because we're not going to get anywhere.
Okay.
I mean, right? Or the other person just caves, but typically, I'm pretty clear, I'm pretty directive at a certain point. You know, most of my mediations are resolved between 3 and 5 meetings, sometimes faster.
Depends on how much the settlement is, but yes, that seems to be a good number. I've seen that.
Depends on how you practice. I mean, some people take a lot longer. I tend to be quicker, probably all those years in New York City. I'm like,
that's right. The results-oriented gets the couple down the road faster so they can live their lives faster, right?
That's right. But even if there's a big marital pot, I mean, I bring in a CDFA, for those of you who don't know what that is, a certified divorce financial analyst, right? So maybe we go offline for a few weeks while they do some of that work. If there's businesses to be evaluated, you bring in a business evaluator. If there's a mental health issue that needs to be managed, I do a lot of high net worth, high conflict cases, and it's fine. I do the full range. I always say, do you remember Encyclopedia Brown? No case too big or too small.
Yes.
That's how I feel, right? So,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So now we have a couple that you've guided through. Oh, excuse me. One last question before we have a couple you've guided through to the end of mediation. What if you're watching somebody, watching a power imbalance? It's not horrifying, but you can see there's a power imbalance. One person is a little more controlling. Maybe that person has the money, but there's a lot of money to move around. Now, the other person is making concessions that they don't have to make, but they're making them. So you have to kind of let it unfold. And they're making decisions against their own best choices, and you can see it blowing up in both of their faces when the divorce is over because life and logistics will take over. What do you do as a mediator?
So you just raised like a lot of different issues, right? So a case that's going to blow up in both of their faces, that's an easy one, right? You just say, you guys, I understand you've done a lot of work together. This is wonderful. This is amazing. Give them a lot of,
positive reinforcement.
Positive reinforcement. Yes. And let them know what the pitfalls are potentially. And get those parties. I've got cases like this right now, you know, in live time. You get them to a lawyer, you caucus them. You take each into a separate room. Now, sometimes that's hard because, you know, you're mediating online and the people are still living together, so there is no privacy. So you can't have those private conversations. I like having the ability to have caucus. I get a lot done in one room, you know, enabling somebody. Yes. They might be afraid to talk about something in front of the other party.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of different ways to do this, but I do feel like I do my best to balance the power in the room. It is not, though, the mediator's job to do that. You need to figure out, if you're hiring a mediator, you need to make sure you go to somebody who whose brand of mediating works for you. Some mediators are entirely neutral, I think to a fault sometimes, because then as a lawyer, I get the agreements and they're a mess, or they don't address the law at all. I don't even know if they even bring up that there is a law. And I don't think it's their responsibility. Like, strictly speaking, that is not the job of the mediator. They need to alert the parties to the issues. But like, how much? If you go to a non-lawyer mediator, I think there's even a lower threshold of what their responsibility is. Again, depending where you live, depending if there's like...
Gabrielle, I'm a non-lawyer mediator, and I'm very acutely aware of it.
Right.
And when something comes up in a mediation, I do not want to quote law. Because then you can lose your neutrality, because the law will favor one person over the other, and you never want to put yourself in that position. So what I do is I say, well, on this particular point, before you close on resolution, I think you should ask your attorneys to clarify a few things for you, so that if you still want to make this decision, it's with informed consent. Another good phrase, right?
Exactly. And that's what I would do too. 100%.
And then there are different styles of mediation. There's a more directive style. Would you speak to that? And only real attorneys can do directive and what we call narrative, correct?
Yeah, so I tend to be quite directive at a certain point. So I would say I'm sort of a hybrid, right? Like I try to let the parties arrive at their own resolutions before I give them ideas. But I do always ask if they want me to give them other ideas, other ways to resolve it that they may or may not have thought of. And if there's a problem with their ideas or if they're really stuck, I will chime in. Also, if I'm mediating with a couple who's not in New York or Massachusetts, I'm only a lawyer in those two places, right? So what I do is I will direct them to go and meet with a lawyer to find out what their rights are, because sometimes things just don't sound right.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But lastly, on mediation, before we start talking about your book, you know, people do kind of want the mediator at some points in time to step in and say something definitive.
I totally agree with that.
Do you, in what you consider to be the right way, step in to give them some direction?
I'm going to say it depends. If they need it, I always give it. If they don't need it, you know, I'm not so smug as to say that I know better what's going on in their life than they know what they need in their life. But probably, you know, I haven't taken an actual poll, but I'm going to guess that in more than half the cases, I give some direction.
Yeah, okay. And just to finish that, then I will say, and this is for everybody listening as well, mediators don't really know you. We really don't know the dynamics that are driving your conversations, the historical experiences you've had that bring you to this point. And we're in California, we're a no-fault divorce state. At some point, if you mediate with people long enough, it'll get blurted out. But you don't ask, and you go from this point forward, you work in present time going forward to help them craft a settlement that works for them in the future. But I think mediators are a disadvantage in terms of giving the couple direction, because there's so much underlying the decision to get divorced that we can never get to know. And if we step on that emotional landmine incorrectly, it can blow up in everybody's face, can it not?
Absolutely.
Let's go to Better Apart. And we may have to do a second interview, Gabrielle, because there's so much in this book that we'll never get to talk about in the next 8 to 10 minutes. But Better Apart, you can buy it on Amazon. You wrote it in, when did you say, 2016, 18?
It came out in 19.
It came out in 19. Okay. And you did have a partner, Elena Brower, that you wrote it with. But here's what I want to start with, and then we'll do the best we can. You have written a recipe, so to speak, for how this can work well. And your recipe includes the ingredients of patience, respect, clarity, peace, and forgiveness.
That's right.
Very difficult recipe, and it has to work together.
But it's all about you. Those things are all about you. So patience with yourself, respect for yourself, forgiveness and acceptance of your situation, right? Like, I'm not saying you need to respect someone who betrayed you or be patient necessarily with bad behavior, because some of these things require, you know, boundary setting, right? Like how can you become more patient? You can set stronger boundaries so you create more space so that you can make better decisions. So this recipe is actually a recipe to enliven and take charge of your own inner agency so that you have more power over your path forward, and so that you're no longer complicit in your own undoing, which we all are, right? Like, if you think about, like, many things in our lives, I realized that, you know, even before I wrote, probably about a year before I wrote Better Parts, so many of my own life circumstances that I wasn't pleased with, I actually helped to, if not create, then support. So, I mean, and I think that's, I'm not embarrassed to say that, because I think that's human. I think that's how we all are in our lives, most of us at least.
So let's start with the first ingredient. Let's talk about patience. How does that play out? Patience with ourselves. In what ways?
So rather than responding to something impulsively.
Yes, go on.
What we can do is learn to respond rather than reacting. Take a pause. Go for a walk around the block. Well, right here, it's snowing right now and freezing, so I don't want to take a walk, but maybe I'll just sit here and take a couple of deep breaths, light a fire at the fireplace. You know, take a time out and then come back to whatever is bothering you. Because especially when you're going through a divorce, but for me, I'm like an incredibly impatient person. It's really important that you realize that we can't rush other people's processes. We can't rush, you know, we can't rush the legal process. We can't rush the law catching up with the times. Like, there's so many different things to be impatient with. All we can do is slow down our own reactivity. And that's what patience is about, slowing down our own reactivity.
I completely love that for these reasons. First of all, the feeling of upset and anxiety when you're going through a divorce is unbelievable. It's obviously different in different relationships, but even the most amicable, you're entering foreign territory, divorce. You've never done it before. And so even those people have to take their time. But for the normal situation where there is a period in the process where there is tension, and the tension comes out in the communication, text, email, verbal, phone calls, in person. A, nobody's required to respond to an angry anything, are they?
Absolutely not. Although, you may be required to reply to an email, which may have some anger in it, right? So there are ways that you can create a container around your response so that you're not being led into upset, right? So for instance, you may decide to put all your communicating on a co-parenting app, such as like the FAIR app or, you know,
Our family wizard out here in the West Coast. Yeah.
One of those applications, and or you may create an email that is designated just for your ex, and you open it once a day, and you only are required, maybe depending on your agreement, to reply to action-oriented requests for reply, right? So if you just get like a nasty gram, just keep it there for your lawyer to see if necessary. That's one of the reasons, by the way, I'm a big advocate of using an app. That way everything is there for everybody to see. It will help to moderate nasty gram behavior.
And then on the part of the writer of the communication, take a minute before you send anything to really review what's important, what's not important, and could you phrase something differently? Because when we put things in writing, it's void of voice context.
Right.
And it could easily be misinterpreted, our intention, our meeting, and so easily done because we're fearful. Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Or sad or insecure or scared, the whole suite of emotions that we experience.
And really, there is a gentleman, I don't know if we mentioned his name when we were talking previously, Bill Eddy, E-D-D-Y.
Oh, yeah.
The
I know
Biff Method, B-I-F-F, brief, informative, friendly, and firm. It really works.
Mm-hmm.
Even with people that have personality disorders and are send frenzies of texts and emails, you don't answer everyone. Maybe let them pile up and at the end of the day, gather everything and do Biff. Thank you very much for your communication. I understand what you're trying to say. For me, I have a different point of view. Let's see how this can work in mediation.
Exactly. I can see you've done your Biff reading.
I do Biff on a daily basis. Yes, yes. Okay, so that's patience. Respect.
Respect is all about you, right? So a lot of that has to do with creating stronger boundaries around the people and circumstances who get you upset, work you up, get you off of your zen. I know we're hitting towards an hour, Judy.
So I know. I looked at the time.
Yeah,
as well. We're going to have to do the whole book in a whole separate session.
Yeah, I think
for
so.
It.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Why don't we plan to do that? But
okay, but the book, so let's just conclude right here. The book is phenomenal. Let's start with
Thank
that.
You.
I absolutely loved reading it. And you know, I read everything. The book is called Better Apart on Amazon. So easy enough to buy. You have been listening to Gabrielle Hartley, attorney and mediator, but prefers mostly mediation. Gabrielle, how can people get in touch with you?
Oh, thank you for asking. So just go on over to GabrielleHartley.com and be sure also to check out the Better Apart blog. I have weekly inspiration from all kinds of thought leaders, including you, I believe, Judith.
March 2nd, I think you have me scheduled.
Okay, good. I'm excited.
Me too.
And just go to GabrielleHartley.com and you can receive your Survive and Thrive bundle by putting in your name and email address, and then you get the Better Part blog right into your inbox. And I offer online mediation as well as training for divorce professionals 4 times a year.
And your online mediation, it can be outside of Massachusetts and New York?
Oh, anywhere in the whole country, absolutely. I work all over.
Okay, so I'm just going to do your email address again. It's Gabrielle with 2 L's, and we'll have your name when we upload this next week. Gabrielle at GabrielleHartley.com.
That's my email. And then my website is just GabrielleHartley.com.
Okay, excellent. Gabrielle, thank you. You've been phenomenal. I, again, have learned from you. Excellent.
Thank you so much. It was really fun.
Thank you. And if I've learned, everybody's learned. So we have to have, you're agreeing to come back. Is that right?
Absolutely.
And we're going to do the book.
Sounds great.
All right. Thank you, Gabrielle. And thank you, everybody, for listening. I really appreciate the time you take and the interest that you take in educating yourself about divorce and your options to the most amicable end. I'm Judith Weigel, your host. You can reach me at Judy at constructiveuncoupling.com, judy@constructiveuncoupling.com. Tell your friends, subscribe to the podcast, and have an amicable week. We will see you next week. Take care.